that you're, what you are telling us is not just going to be what will be in the report, but that will be preserved as a historic record and go to the National Archives, and researchers will be able to look at it for many years ahead.
Okay.
So one of the things that we're doing here is not just investigating for our report and for the all the materials that we're going to be able to put on the web, but we're also establishing a historic record. And I think, as you said before, and as you know, we all come increasingly every day here to realize what we're looking at is a historic event that's happened in the United States. And anyway. And as the Chinese say, may you not live in interesting times.
Well, yes, it is. It is. You just have to know that we say this. It is our generation, maybe not yours where you are, but it is this generation and this community's Great Depression. Because we're 10 years in, and there's no light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes.
And if you want to look up what we've been doing on this land bank, part of why we're doing this land bank is because we believe that the only hope for communities like ours is to gather as much of this land as we possibly can and aggregate it for some time in the future when it has value.
Right, right. Well, I wanted you to go back and tell me a little bit more about the progression of events. Now, you know, part of what we're doing is we're looking at the ways the federal government handled what's happened. And so you talked a little bit about your experience with the Fed in 2001. But try to move through some of the other years and tell us some of the places that you went to look for help and what reaction you got.
I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Uh-huh.
I think if you interviewed a man named Greg White, who was the U.S. Attorney for the Northeast District of Ohio under George Bush, he will tell you I went there, and it might have been 04 and 05, begging for help. Set up a large meeting where I basically ranted and raved and gesticulated a lot and said, you've got to do something about this. You're the federal government. This is fraud on a massive scale. And he'll tell you that, by the way. The meeting included people from the FBI. It involved postal inspectors. It involved people from the U.S. Attorney's Office. And at the end of the day, I basically was told that they were under a lot of stress and strain because of the Homeland Security, and that they were investigating all kinds of white-collar crime, and that eventually they would try to get to this, and in fact they had done some, but, you know, look, not enough. And, you know, whatever they did late. They did too little too late. And, you know, I said this in the beginning, if they had attacked this early and had come after this problem early on, I think they could have sent a signal. They would have sent a signal. And the signal would have been one that I think would have been powerful. You start putting people away to jail, that's likely to slow down your mortgage machine. But it never happened. Let's see, what else?
What year do you think it could have been nipped in the bud? Is there a year that you think it could have been reduced?
Well, if they had introduced tough rules early on, and when I say they, I mean the Fed early on, and used the power and the authority they had under the Homeownership Equity Protection Act back in the early aughts. Now that Greenspan had said these loans aren't sustainable, instead of at one point in his public career talking about the virtues of adjustable rate mortgages, which he did in one of his speeches, if we had taken an early and aggressive approach, and I'm talking 00, 01, 02, we could have made a difference. But we didn't. And
Do you blame Alan Greenspan?
Oh, in the Gallery of Rogues, I think he has he's pretty high up on the chart. I mean, if I had to put somebody at the top,
uh-huh.
He represents the Fed and he represents, you know, the Federal Reserve Bank. I'd put him at the top or close to. But as you come to know this crisis, there's enough blame to go around. I mean, you know, Democrats had a role in dropping, you know, the final elements of Glass-Steagall back in the late 90s. The Credit Futures Modernization Act was one that was pushed by Phil Graham, but Democrats were on board. I mean, there were plenty of villains. And eventually, those villains, you know, came from the Democratic side of this as well as the Republican side. And if you think about, I mean, let's talk about Credit Futures Modernization Act. I was giving a talk recently to a bunch of folks.
And you mean commodities, right? Commodities futures.
Is it commodities futures? The one in PESCA 99? That's
yes.
The one that allows
yes.
the unregulated trade of credit default swaps.
Yes, right.
Right.
Yeah,
how do you explain to a person in the public, this is how credit default swaps work? There was a special called Power of Peril or Power in Peril. Got on CNBC recently by David Faber. I know a little bit about it because I happened to be in it. They didn't use this quote. I wish they had. Try to imagine you're a used car salesman and you sell a car that you know has an effective steering mechanism and will crash. Not maybe, certainly. Try to imagine what it's like if you sell a car that you know is going to crash and you make a commission on the sale of that car, but there's this device out there that allows you to buy insurance on that car. Not to pay the aggrieved owner of the car, but to pay you the value of the car when the car crashes.
Yeah.
That's the closest metaphor I can come to for the average guy. The closest. I mean, think about it. That's in effect what credit default swaps are. On the Abacus Fund, Goldman made money on the sale of that one mortgage, residential mortgage-backed security pool, and then turned around and bet against it and made billions on the other end. And it was one that pointed out by Senator Carl Levin and his committee. So I guess my point is, you know, I can point to Greenspan, I can point to the Fed, but I can also tell you that this was made possible by a lot of other earlier actions and also this mistaken belief that everybody should own a home, which I have never believed in, by the way, never. But I digress. What else do you want to know?
So you went in and you went to the attorney in 2004, right, and basically got told that's not a priority right now for us.
That they were interested, but they were really swamped, and they really commended me for my my advocacy of this issue, and have a nice day. You know, you can call a guy named Greg White, ask him what happened. Ask him when I came to see them why they weren't more aggressive.
Did he tell you anything about what was happening inside the Justice Department around this issue?
Not really. I'm not really on those kinds of. I'm not viewed. You know, I'm the local property tax collector. I mean, I imagine he probably shared what was going on with the Justice Department with somebody, but not with me. I mean, I don't remember. You know, again, these are now years old. These meetings.
Yes.
I mean, they're confirmable. There's a flyer here or an actual program from the meeting we did back in March of 2001. Entitled Predatory Lending in Ohio, that talks about who our speakers were and all that other good stuff. So, I mean, clearly that stuff is all, here it is, Predatory Lending for Ohio, Searching for Solutions, one-day conference sponsored by the College of Law, Federal Reserve Bank. If you look on here, it, you know, talks about who all our speakers are, best practices, lunch and keynote. Ed Gramlich was there, legislative options. Anyway.
What was the date?
It was March 23rd, 2001.
Thank you. Sounds like you knocked on every door you could think of.
Yeah, knocked on a lot of them.
What are you going to do when you leave office?
Well, I want to stay involved with this land bank, which if you get a chance, you could probably do a little bit of research and find out about it. It is our best tool right now in Northeast Ohio because it's allowing us to take in hundreds of properties that otherwise would just simply go back into the predatory lending speculation game. And so we'll probably be in possession by year end of at least 1,000 properties, and I think within 3 or 4 years we'll probably have 7 or 8,000 properties in the land bank. Our problem is twofold. We need to create consensus in D.C. to, as I said earlier, create kind of an American Rust Belt City's Marshall Plan, where we just get the resources to take most of these properties down, level the land, and then give us some help on holding them, because holding property is not an inexpensive proposition. And I believe what I said earlier, that someday this will be a valuable and an important place to live again. There will be, you know, we have water, we are close to a lot of major urban centers, and my wife's roommate used to be the water commissioner in Tucson, Arizona. And I know what's going on in that part of the world. It's tough. You know, resources are scarce. And if you believe the global warming climates, we're going to be temperate here someday.
Tell me how you take the land. You talked about bulldozing. You use eminent domain, or you condemn, or what do you do?
Well, first of all, we have a lot of property just being donated to us because nobody wants it. So HUD is giving us about 30 to 50 properties a month. Fannie Mae is giving us 20 to 30 properties a month. We have banks starting to just come into us and giving us properties with the check for demolition.
How many from HUD? I'm sorry, how many from HUD and how many from Fannie Mae? I missed that.
30 to 50
from HUD. Uh-huh, a month.
20 to 30 each month from Fannie Mae. I like the Fannie Mae deal better because they give us a check for each house they give us that covers about half the cost of our demolition. HUD isn't so generous. We, under the new law we wrote, we have this provision that says that when we foreclose on property now, there is no longer an auction. What that means is the property goes directly to the land bank. Under the old model, there would have been an auction, and if the property had value, somebody would buy it and go make money on it, which means they privatized the profit. And if the property had no value, they'd walk away from it. It ended up becoming the responsibility of the government, which means they socialized the losses. Under a land bank, properties that are foreclosed now, all of them, the good and the bad, come directly to the land bank. So we do pick up properties with value, and we put them on the market, and we sell them to promote our corporate mission, which is to acquire and clear.
I must be really obtuse. Just make sure I understand. How is it that you come to hold the notes on the properties, though?
When a property is foreclosed,
yes,
there is no note. It's gone.
So
when a property is foreclosed for non-payment of property taxes?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It eliminates every lien.
Okay.
The property tax lien is a super lien. Mm-hmm. Everything comes off.
Okay.
Now, when we get these properties from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae, Fannie and the HUD, they transfer to us, you know, free and clear. When we have people who bring us these properties they want to donate, there's deeds that have to be, you know, executed, that if the property is encumbered with other obligations, we reject them. But all they have to do is stop paying property taxes, and eventually it will come back to us anyway.
So this, in some ways, this is a very severe case of their assessment that the property is more valuable to you than it will be to them anytime in the near future.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we're meeting now with Bank of America, Tentative, Wells, Chase. They need to charge off most of their properties in Cleveland. They're never going to get their money back.
Right.
Never. I mean, I'll define never as 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, they want to keep paying property taxes and waiting for the day that Cleveland recovers so they can get some of this money back. Mm-hmm. Not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So this is a win-win.
It's a win-win for us because it helps us to create a more stable picture. It's a win for them because they don't want the property on their books, and eventually they're going to charge off the losses anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And will the region have the resources to maintain the property? You were mentioning that that's a concern.
Oh, it is. I'm going to market next week. I'm borrowing $15 million bucks. And I chair that board, and I'll tell you, within a couple of years, we're going to be hurt. We need to get on the radar screen of, forget state government, they're all broke. But at some level, we have to get on the radar screen of federal government, who has to recognize that if we're serious about rebuilding distressed Midwestern urban areas, that they've got to get involved.
Are there some other cities and communities that are like-minded, are starting to get interested in this?
Flint, Michigan did the first one.
Uh-huh.
We kind of copied the Flint model.
Okay.
So the owner of the guy who runs that is now with a group out of Washington called Center for Neighborhood Progress will tell you that the Cuyahoga Land Bank, he will tell you, is their model on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
And he believes it's the best one.
And who else has called you up with interest from other communities?
Oh, well, there's a movement across the state. Toledo,
yep.
Montgomery, Toledo, Lucas County is starting one. Montgomery County, which is Dayton, is starting one. Mahoning County, which is Youngstown, is starting one. Trumbull County, which is Warren, Ohio, is starting one. We are applying to Hamilton County, which is Cincinnati, here in about 2 weeks to speak to their commissioners. And we've met with people from Summit County, which is Akron. So I think land banks will become an accepted tool and part of the, it'll become one of those arrows in the quiver that, you know, is one you just have to have.
Right. Right. I'm just curious, are any of the states that we think of as the sand states, you know, California, Arizona, Florida,
right, I know the sand states.
And any communities in those states that have expressed an interest, or is their land still conceived to be so valuable?
Run the question. Are any of
Are those states still thinking that their land will recover? In other words, they're not interested in the land bank model.
Well, I think they, I think they're more likely to recover because
okay.
they still have a much larger population base.
Right.
Now, I think they are overbuilt in a lot of those communities, but I think you're more likely to see values return sooner.
Yes.
In Arizona and Nevada. Though, by the way, not for a long time to 2005, 2006 levels, but I think it's more likely you'll see recovery there than you will in distressed urban areas in the Midwest. I mean, you're more likely to see Las Vegas recover than Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
You're more likely to see the real estate picture stabilize in Phoenix before it stabilizes in Northeast Ohio. Florida,
yeah.
I don't know. Florida's a different picture. I don't know. I can't really...
Right.
I can't get my arms around Florida.
Right. Yeah, we held a field hearing in Las Vegas, and you're right, Las Vegas has been historically more resilient, but you know, 68% of the homes are underwater there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a, you know, and they've got 15% unemployment.
Yeah, and, you know, our underwater rate here is, we put it over half, you know, it's over half. But, you know, homes that have lost, you know, significant value in Vegas that were, you know, selling for $350 that are now going for $125 or $150,
mm-hmm.
that's a whole different picture than a home in Cleveland mm-hmm. that some idiot put a $120,000 mortgage on that might be worth $30. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
so. And Vegas offers, you know, what it offers. It offers weather and offers gambling, and we're about to get gambling. You know, that'll solve our problems here in Cleveland.
Can I ask you about strategic defaults? How pervasive is that? Or has that been?
You mean strategic? You mean banks walking away?
Nope. Meaning the borrowers themselves decide.
Oh, it's becoming more and more pervasive.
It is.
I get calls every week from people asking me for my advice because I've been kind of upfront on this. And, those are tough calls. I mean, what am I supposed to tell people? It's okay to walk away, but how do I not tell somebody they should walk away when their mortgage is so far underwater, all they're doing is paying on it for the next 30 years, and when they're through paying on it, it'll still be worth, you know, far less than what they invested. Far less. I mean, what do you tell somebody who's sitting in a house that's got a $110,000 mortgage where no house has even sold in their neighborhood in the last year? But if they did, they sold in the 40s. You know, and I just don't get into moral hazards with me, that's all. That's the only one that sends me off the edge. Because, you know, the reality is they should never have gotten the mortgage. The reality is they probably lied on their income. They probably had no down payment. But the flip side of that is somebody encouraged them to lie on there. Somebody told them you don't need a down payment. And in many cases, they had offers to borrow and take out second and even third mortgages.
Right.
I guess the thing that is striking to me about this is, and we've been hearing a lot around the country about sort of increasing numbers of people just willing to walk away, a lot of people are just really angry at the lenders. And it's a different mood than it used to be. I covered the savings loan crisis, and people were very anxious then about maintaining their credit and sort of maintaining themselves and their own sense of themselves as a respectable and honorable person. And I guess it seems to me that things have gotten so bad now that people are feeling differently about maintaining mortgages that they think were where they think that they are the victim.
Well, you've seen the percentage of people. I've seen the studies. I'm sure you have too. In 2006, the percentage of people who thought it was okay to walk away from a mortgage was, what, 11-12%. And the most recent study I saw said that number is up to 39%. What was unthinkable is now becoming very thinkable.
Because the view is it's self-preservation. Is that right?
Self-preservation. I mean, here, I got one last week. A woman living in a condo complex in a suburb of Cleveland called Lakewood. 800 square feet. She probably overpaid for the unit. Told me she didn't have a down payment either. But her $90,000 payment is now exacerbated by an assessment. So her monthly assessment, maintenance, and mortgage are $2,400 a month. Let me tell you, in D.C. or New York, that might get you a studio apartment. Here, that gets you a 4,000-square-foot house with all the amenities you could think of and a beautiful yard. Or in a large apartment complex on the lake, it gets you a three-bedroom view with views of Lake Erie and downtown Cleveland. $2,400 here is a lot of money. Her unit, at best, is worth $30,000. And I think she could not even sell it at $35,000. So what do I tell her? To stay?
So what did you tell her?
Well, I made a mistake. I made the mistake of telling her that if she were my daughter, I would walk. She proceeded to tell half of her condo complex that. The last time I give advice to people, I got angry calls from the management of the condo complex. I was livid with her. She was the friend of a friend. And I gave her honest advice. I thought she'd keep to herself. Boy, was that dumb. Anyway.
Well, it's not going to be your problem soon.
Yeah.
You know, right. you've been carrying this on your shoulders a long time.
Yeah.
I live here,
and I don't see the way out. Unless, you know, I testified on behalf of Durbin's, cram down bill. Not going to happen. Banks won't allow it. Again, until they're prepared to realize these losses.
Well, I guess the thing I wanted to follow up about this is this increasing number of people being willing to walk away. This is something that I think is really going to come around and bite the lenders. Is that in the past, they were able to really, they'd make a loan and they could feel really pretty confident that people would try to pay it back. That's not going to be true anymore.
No. Those days are over. I'm telling you, we have a chart. I've got them somewhere. I should probably try to get to these. I have a chart been done that shows what the average equity was in a home in this country from 1953 to current. And initially, in the early 50s, it was in the 80% range. It came to about 70% and leveled out there for years. It's now dropped to about 30%. That loss in equity caused by, you know, overborrowing and also by loss of value of the property represents trillions. That's trillions of dollars of lost wealth in this country. And the biggest losers in this town are the people who are not walking away, who've paid their mortgage off, and thought in their home they had a viable part of their retirement strategy. And now it's an albatross. They can't sell it. They're stuck. I talked to a woman once who said that she was going to sell her house. They were going to use it to bury her. She couldn't sell the house now. She wanted to.
The folks who walk away from their houses, do you have any evidence that they're staying in the state, or do they try to get mobile and get out?
Well, that's the one good thing about people when they get foreclosed. Their mobility is increased, isn't it? I mean, that's, you know, there are those who argue, you've seen the economists who argue that mortgage isn't always a good thing for a mobile workforce.
Right.
I would say that my anecdotal evidence is some move, mm-hmm. some stay because they have family here.
Mm-hmm. And then they rent?
They rent. They double up. They move in with mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
They move in with a roommate.
Mm-hmm.
Or they just rent.
Right.
Plenty for houses for rent here in town.
I'll bet.
Plenty of apartments.
I'll bet. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you think that you want to tell us about this or that you want to put onto the record?
Yeah, I just think it's an American tragedy, and it is sickening to me that, and this is not, you know, political hyperbole, but it's sickening to me. At a time that Wall Street continues to pay out record bonuses, the communities like this one that have suffered because of those excesses will never see those bonuses and will, struggle for years, for generations to come as a result of this damage. Not that Cleveland didn't have plenty in place in advance that caused these damages. And, you know, when I wrote this article for the Washington Post, I really got a kick out of all the, I was forced to do an online chat the following Monday, and the number of people who wrote in with vitriol and anger and bile, basically saying Cleveland's to blame for its own problems and Cleveland did this to itself and don't blame the bankers. You know, I just think that is, it's the one thing I can't understand about this country, that to give people on Wall Street a free pass for creating this disaster is, to me, just something I'll never understand for as long as I live. But that's it.
Well, it was a fabulous article, by the way. It was an excellent article, and I just think that you, unfortunately, as you've been, you're ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
In 2007, the country had not come to grips with this, and if anything, you know, sort of the bailout just sort of staved off the recognition of the enormity of the problem. And I think sort of only now are we really seeing it. I just think you've had the bad luck of being...
Cassandra?
Yes.
Whoever she was in Greek, whatever. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
I'm a Greek. I should know that, right?
Right.
Anyway.
One last question. What do you make from where you are about the foreclosure documentation flaws, the brouhaha that's still bubbling about what to do over that? Do you have any sense of how important or not important that may be?
Oh, I think it's going to slow the foreclosure mill up a little. If it can be used to the benefit of homeowners to possibly, force modifications, wouldn't that be wonderful? But I just think it's going to, and I'm also kind of not amused, but I'm as I said this on Racing, why are you surprised that the same lack of care that they exhibited in granting these mortgages is now being exhibited in the way they foreclosed on property? I mean, people are just saying, how could they do this? I said, well, I have a better one. How could they have given a loan to somebody without a job? How could they have given a loan to somebody without a job with no down payment? So I'm more shocked by that than the fact that they've used robo-signers or they don't know where the notes are. If we can use this crisis to force loan modifications and keep some people in their homes and stabilize neighborhoods, great.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Jim. I really appreciate it. This has been
thanks
really helpful.
Much,
thank you for covering
for
so much.
Thanks for your time.
Really
appreciate it.
If you can think of anything else that you want to add, let me...
Can I bring up LeBron James? Just kidding, ladies. Wait a minute. Did you say the savings and loan crisis? You really have been around for a while.
Yes, yes.
Well, you go back to the SNL crisis.
Yes.
The Keating Five, huh?
Yes, yeah. I do. Yes, I do.
All right.
You know, nothing. It's been so much fun. I just couldn't give it up.
You couldn't give it up. Well,
yep, I
have a friend. I have a friend who writes, my best friend in college is a reporter for the, it used to be the Chicago Tribune, but now it's Byline. I think is LA Times, and he's living in Silver Springs. He's covering the FDA. His name is Andy Zajac, and I hear from him the miseries of being in the newspaper business. So,
yes.
Bad.
Yes, well, there's not a lot of good news these days.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you.